From the Sky News Centre at 5, Libyan rebels say Colonel Gaddafi's forces are still attacking them, despite having declared a ceasefire. The announcement was made as a result of last night's UN resolution. It authorised a no-fly zone and all necessary action by international forces to protect the civilians short of invasion. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says there's a long way to go.
While this resolution is an important step, it is only that, an important step. We and our partners will continue to explore the most effective measures to end this crisis.
A British Airways computer expert's been jailed for 30 years for plotting to launch a 9/11 style terror attack from the UK. Rajib Karim, who's 31, planned to exploit staff shortages during BA strike action to blow up a flight bound for the US. Deputy Assistant Commissioner Stuart Osborne says Karim tried to use his IT skills to avoid detection.
Experts from the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command spent 9 months decrypting 300 coded messages found on his computer hard drive. It was the most sophisticated decryption task of its kind ever undertaken by the Counter-Terrorism Command.
A father who drove his car into a river while his two children were inside has been convicted of murdering his five-year-old daughter. Christopher Grady's also been convicted of attempting to murder his six-year-old son in Worcestershire. Two brothers who conned thousands of customers into visiting what they claimed was a Lapland-style theme park have both been jailed for 13 months. Victor and Henry Mears offered visitors a winter wonderland with snow-covered log cabins, a nativity scene and polar bears. But instead, disappointed families found a muddy field, a broken ice rink and fairy lights hung from trees. Sport and long run beat competition from two previous winners to finish first in the Cheltenham Gold Cup. Denman finished second for a second consecutive year, with Quarto Star third. And the dates for the FA Cup semi-finals at Wembley have been confirmed. The Manchester Derby will take place on Saturday the 16th of April. Bolton plays Stoke the following day.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and on the day elitist turned UK Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark announced plans to make squatting a criminal offence, and homeless people were evicted from Bristol City Council's former housing advice centre, The Hub, we ask, is it justice to tell our police to arrest the penniless and let billionaire banking fraudsters go free? And while the Met drug squad say reggae artist Smiley Culture stabbed himself to death while being arrested, we ask, after a death a week in custody without a single police conviction, do the boys in blue have a licence to kill? I'm joined this week by Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dobell, and Conservative councillor for Stockwood, Dave Morris. Then, after the 6 o'clock news, as Fukushima joins Chernobyl and Three Mile Island in the annals of nuclear infamy, we talk to local residents about the two new nuclear stations planned upwind of Bristol, that's Hinckley and Oldbury, and we ask, what might happen if there's a terrorist attack at a nuclear plant round the Bristol Channel? And when it comes to nuclear power, why are lies and cover-ups the norm? The UN Secretary General and the Security Council has declared war on Gaddafi. Is it just, and what's the bigger picture? Plus, Jews have got the Book of Daniel and the Christians have Revelation. But many Orthodox Muslims believe that wars unfolding now in Pakistan, North Africa and the Middle East were all predicted in the Quran 1500 years ago. And they expect Jesus will come back as a Muslim. We hear from Muslim think tank Global Vision 2000, who are holding a mini conference in the House of Lords later this month. That's in the second hour after six. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Tonight, mild frost, dry with a north wind. This weekend, 9 to 10 degrees Celsius. Cloud cover and rain pretty much dry, actually. Wind will be southerly. Next week, climbing through the week, temperatures up to 15 degrees Celsius. So getting nice and dry and sunny. But next weekend, that's the 26th and 27th of March, cooling down to 8 degrees Celsius. Raining on Saturday and remaining cloudy, but not quite so rainy on Sunday next weekend. Noticeably windy. 25 to 30 miles an hour. Week after next, 6 to 7 degrees Celsius, cloudy with light rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. LibDemCouncillorHengrove.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now. With me is Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dooble. Hi, Sylvia, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, first of all, what got you into politics?
Well, I guess what got me into politics was very many years ago when I was forever complaining about the state of the roads and the fact that they weren't swept and there were potholes. And my husband said to me, for goodness sake, instead of moaning, get in there and do something about it. And so I did.
And why the Lib Dems and not one of the other parties then?
Oh, I'm a Liberal in my heart. I've always believed in fairness. I've always believed that a cat's as good as a king. I don't believe that, you know, I'm a great believer in equality and fairness and honesty. There was no other party for me at all.
What about committees? Which committees are you on the City Council?
On this City Council, I'm on the Overview and Scrutiny Management Committee, and I'm also on the Development Control North Committee.
So what have you had any interesting planning permissions you've granted or not granted recently on the Development Control? Because it's always a bit contentious, isn't it, these planning committees?
I think it's a bit like a gladiatorial arena, really, the planning committees. Yes, I subbed in on the Sainsbury's decision. 2 weeks ago, might have been last week, time forgets, and I've sat in on power stations at Avonmouth as well since I've been on this planning committee.
So what were your thoughts on Sainsbury's then, and how did you vote on that one?
Well, I actually voted to turn it down. I was the only person who did, but I listened to all the arguments with great care. I weighed up the balance of the enablement against the possible destruction, really, of Bedminster and the nuisance to the residents, and I felt that the price was just too much to pay, so I voted against it, but I was the only one.
It does seem a little bit unfair, doesn't it, that Sainsbury's can come along with one after another attempts at planning permission. The first time it's turned down, so they just come up with another one and they keep going until they get accepted.
Well, they had amended it, and I think in some ways they had attempted to meet some of the concerns of the original planning committee, but for my mind it was described as a food store when it's in fact the largest sort of hypermarket in the whole of the southwest, and with a 240% increase in non-food sales, and that for me was just a step too far.
Now, the Liberal Democrat Party in Bristol is certainly not in alliance with the Conservatives, but it is up in Westminster.
Yes.
Do you think you're getting enough bangs for your buck up at Westminster from Nick Clegg? Are you getting what you want from the coalition?
You're never going to get exactly what you want, because a coalition is not like one party government. A coalition is an agreement between two parties, and there has to be much compromise. I think on the whole we've done reasonably well. Nobody really wants to be in coalition, absolutely nobody, but I do believe that our party did it because the country is in an absolutely dire state. We are virtually bankrupt, and we do have to consider the future of the country and everybody, and that is why we've gone into coalition. And I do think both parties, both the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, are sincere in wanting to do this for the good of the country.
I mean, many people would say we're not bankrupt, it's just that we're not collecting taxes from the big corporations and from the super rich.
Oh, I think it's a well-known fact that we have been spending well beyond our means, and that the biggest problem in the minute is that even at the end of 5 years, we still will owe money. This is just to try and pay off the interest we're paying every single day. It's quite alarming, really. We have got to get ourselves into a better state of finance, and maybe we've all learned to expect us too much.
Well, I'm also joined by Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Dave Morris. Hi, Dave. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
First of all, then, what about you? What made you join the Conservative Party?
Well, when I started getting interested in politics, which is as soon as I was old enough to vote, I looked at the main parties. I originally came from West Wales, and there was a Scottish Nationalist Party down there, and I looked at Welsh nationalism, Liberals, Conservatives, as it was in those days. In fact, in my hometown, it was a Lib-Con coalition in those days, it's just in the 50s. But when I actually came to vote and I was living in London, I looked around, and in those days there was the Labour Party going out on strikes, there was a lot of militants seemed to be ruling the country and trying to rule the economy, so it just naturally drifted to conservatism.
Okay, and what about committees on the City Council? What are you up to on there?
Well, I have been, until last year, always been on social services, because my main interest has always been children who suffer from deprivation and the elderly. And one of the reasons why I became a councillor was to help those with greatest need who couldn't, for whatever reason, couldn't help themselves. Currently, I'm on licensing and public safety and protection committees.
Well, at the moment, the City Council is slowly divesting itself of responsibility for these old people's homes. And in a way, these kind of services are starting to become privatised, aren't they? So what are your thoughts about that? Is that a positive thing?
Well, no, not really. I don't think it's privatising them is the answer. I think there are many locally run establishments. What they've done, which is extremely good and brilliant in Bristol, is the Very Shelter scheme, which is financed through Bristol City Council, but is run by specialist organisations because of the intensive care that the residents will need, depending on their age and their ability. I'm very impressed with the over 600 units that the city have got.
Now, we're about 120 miles away from London here. How satisfied are you with David Cameron's support performance so far?
Well, I must be honest with you, I'm not a friend of the coalition. I would be much happier if he'd gone on his own and looked probably for another election in the years later down the line. That is my own personal view. It may not be my party's view, but that's why, from the personal point of view, I think, generally speaking, I think he's doing quite a good job.
Why is that? Because, you know, it's actually more of a fragile thing to do, to try and pursue government just as a minority party or without a working majority, isn't it?
It can be very difficult, but then I'm not a politician of that ilk. You know, I don't even pretend. I've been asked to stand for Parliament. I refuse. It's not a career that I would look for and even aspire to. Never have done.
So do you think that David Cameron has had to make compromises because of the coalition? And what are you unhappy about?
I think he's got to make compromises. I think there are several things which we've had to compromise on. And neither party can be happy of the outcome. That's the way I look at it.
Well, is there anything specifically, though, that you think, well, hang on, this is we really shouldn't have done this, and if we'd have not been in a coalition with the Liberals, we wouldn't have had to? Yeah.
I would have thought one thing I would like to see is the human rights issue reviewed. Whether we have a British constitution, maybe, but I think the fact that we cannot kick out people in this country who come over to this country to try and blow us up, for instance, and cannot be kicked out or commit crimes because it's against their human rights, I think that's totally outrageous.
Okay, well, let's move on to have a look at this week's news now. First of all, we've got reports that the Bristol Royal Infirmary this week has been making elementary mistakes in its diagnosis. Here is the ITV West's Rebecca Broxton with a report from West Country last night. So we'll have a chat about that after we've heard her.
Just 3 months after the people of Bristol were told diagnostic services at the city's Royal Infirmary were safe, the West Country Tonight can reveal there's been another serious error.
We understand a patient was told she had breast cancer and underwent surgery, but a mistake had been made in her diagnosis. She didn't need the treatment and was, in fact, perfectly healthy.
Tonight, there are calls for a full public inquiry into allegations of misdiagnoses at the BRI's pathology labs. Our health correspondent Rebecca Broxton reports.
Concerns over the pathology unit at the Bristol Royal Infirmary were first raised nearly 7 years ago. Five doctors from different hospitals said they feared serious blunders were being repeatedly made. As a result, an independent inquiry was carried out. It looked at a number of cases like Jane Hope's. She had a lump in her breast checked out by pathologists at the BRI and was told it was benign. 2 years later, the same sample was looked at again, this time by pathologists at Frenche, who concluded it had, in fact, shown pre-invasive cancer of the breast. The cancer spread, and Jane died. Then there was Iris Nix from Wootton Under Edge. She was told she had breast cancer and underwent surgery. Days later, she was told a mistake had been made, and she never had breast cancer at all. The independent inquiry into alleged misdiagnosis looked in detail at 26 individual cases and concluded serious errors were made in three. Another 3,000 cases were also reviewed. Despite criticising working practices, the inquiry team concluded there was no evidence to lead it to believe that the BRI provided anything other than a safe service. But tonight, we can reveal another serious error was reported just days after the inquiry team presented its findings.
Now, Sylvia, Lib Dem councillor, City Councillor here in Bristol, this is a little bit disturbing, isn't it? Because just after we have a report that everything's been cleared up and it's all working fine, we hear that there are more misdiagnoses going on at the BRI. And it's had quite a checkered history, the BRI, hasn't it?
Well, I think it has, but as someone who has herself suffered from breast cancer, I understand the anxieties of all this. But I think one has to put it into context. I mean, it's dreadful that mistakes are made, but when you think of the thousands, and I mean thousands of x-rays, breast x-rays, or any x-rays, and the amount of pressure that the hospital is working on, then I personally think that the number of errors obviously got to be regretted and not going to be any greater than any other hospital in this country. The BRI and also the I think one of the Greater London hospitals, that they've made reports on them about having the same kind of problems. So clearly nobody wants a mistake to be made, but I think if you look at the percentage against the literally thousands and thousands of x-rays and operations they're carried out, it's probably within the sort of reasonable statistical error, and it's dreadful to have to put it down to statistics, but everybody knows that mistakes are made, and of course it's deeply regrettable.
Dave, are you happy that there's enough oversight of our hospitals? Because, I mean, it was about 6-7 years ago now that they got rid of the community health councils, which used to be a way for patients to directly input if they'd had an unsatisfactory service from the NHS. And those were gotten rid of quite a long time ago. Are you happy that the oversight now of our health services is up to scratch?
Well, I can only talk from personal experience. I am a long-term renal patient at South Mews Hospital. And quite frankly, I've only got nothing but praise for them. I'm a home dialysing patient. I've got end-stage renal failure. I've got a renal nurse. I've got a consultant. I've got a dietitian. I've got a blood department. All give me support. So from my own personal point of view, I think the hospital is fantastic. Now, I've also recently had a heart attack, which meant I had to go into the BRI for a bypass operation. So I was in South Mead for 2 months waiting to get into the BRI. That was a bit of a drawback. It's the waiting to get access to the cardiac services of the BRI. And having said that, once I got into the BRI, again, they were brilliant. I got no faults on the service given. You mentioned about the odd mistakes made. They must be. They're bound to make odd mistakes. Only people are human, after all. And mistakes will be made. Unfortunately, some of them can be fatal. But majority of cases, they are very successful.
So you're saying the NHS, you think it is up to scratch and that there is enough oversight?
certainly from the medical point of view, where I think we've got a problem is in the long-term elderly population. You know, is the keeping elderly in hospital when they really need to go into sort of some form of care? And that is the problem, the bed blocking that we call it. Mm-hmm. I think that is one of the main drags on and drains on the hospital budgets.
So what exactly is bed blocking?
It's people who could leave hospital, who do not need medical care, but need general care, which can be supplied by, or has been, by social services and home care in people's own homes. But some people obviously can't manage in their own homes, but they go into care homes.
So what would you like to see done about that then?
Well, that was... The answer is to look at the care homes we've got. This is where I would put funding, more funding to go in, because Bristol actually are very good. Under the last government, hospital authorities were fined if they had patients, more than, say, 20, I think it was, patients, blocking beds, because they could have been admitted elsewhere. And Bristol, I don't think Bristol were ever fined for that. So we have quite a good record that they actually put money in, and they had social workers based in the hospitals to assess the patients as they came approaching discharge.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Now, on to our next story. And this week, Dispatches, the Channel 4 documentary investigative series, took a look at Britain's secret fat cats. And at the reporter Ben Lawrence, in the Blakeway Productions film, explained that there are a lot of private businesses that are now doing very, very well out of providing public services.
Norwich faced a crisis. Along with several councils across the country, it had to find emergency contractors to provide vital services to residents. In the aftermath, the council considered the idea of bringing the services back in-house.
Recently, the Contacts Working Party has had another look about into the possibility of having a direct labour force again. And we are told that the council doesn't have the expertise and knowledge. And then we're told it would cost something like £500,000 to actually set such a service up.
As Norwich discovered, all too often privatisation is a one-way street. Once you move your public services to the private sector, it can be very costly if things go wrong.
I think the risk of the private sector supply going bust is always present, and we know from past experience the public sector has to step in. That is, however much the public sector contracts out or gets new kinds of organisations, big society bodies, to provide services. So you can never quite get away from the fact that if the private sector company were to go under or fail, then the public sector always bears that risk.
David Cameron has told us that now we are the ones in charge. We are meant to believe that this is the essence of the big society, individuals and communities being given the freedom to run their own lives. But what will the big society really give us?
When David Cameron and others started to talk about the big society, it felt very cuddly, didn't it? Now, when it comes to the crunch, what's it really about? What we can see now is that it's about privatising the welfare state on a massive scale.
As the government squeezes the public finances, a handful of huge companies are prospering, not despite the cuts, but because of them.
It's quite possible for a private sector company to provide excellent services to the public. However, its motive is ultimately to produce profit. That is a driven part of its bottom line, and in some cases its only bottom line.
The big society feels like little more than privatisation in disguise, and we need to ask ourselves if that is what we genuinely want. Because there is a real danger that power is shifting not to individuals, but to big business.
That's reporter Ben Lawrence from Dispatches on Monday evening this week. Now, Dave, first of all, I'll ask you about this first, as you're a Conservative councillor. The big society, is it just privatisation in disguise?
I would say it's most certainly not, actually. Big society is people, from my level, is for people within the community, helping others within the community. This is I come from. This is what I call the big society. It's all the question of meals on wheels or people to take services from the council. But when you've got an elderly neighbour or something, which often goes on already, is that people will look after these elderly people, will look after people who need some form of service or help, go shopping for people who are disabled. I do that. You know, it's the general issue. When you talk about a national, that's a different kettle of fish as far as I'm concerned. I worry about my local areas, and this is where there is a lot of goodwill in all areas of the city. There's many very good, decent, caring people, and without them, life would be unbearable. When you only look at the carers.
There are a lot of these companies like Serco, for example. They're actually now private companies providing these public services, and the bosses are making an absolute fortune, six-figure salaries.
Well, that may well be. You've got the bankers as well making a fortune. That's not in my world. You know, well, I don't make a fortune.
But no, this is with public money.
Yeah. But then what was happening beforehand, there are certain issues. I don't know about Serco, but I do know about... you take direct labour groups in Bristol City Council. At one time, they had all the contacts in the city and charging a lot of money. Along come private companies, CETA and others, who forced the council to lower their prices and give a better value for money. And the city council worked for value for money situation. I don't know of any companies making a fortune out of the Bristol City. I couldn't talk about that.
Sylvia, you're a Lib Dem councillor. Are you in agreement here? Do you think that there is an element of the big society being a kind of cover for privatisation?
Not at all. I actually think of John F. Kennedy's quote, "Do not ask what my country can do for me, rather what can I do for my country." I do believe it's up to every individual to take a control and do something for their own communities, and that's what the big society is about to me, that people giving a hand in the community, not saying it's the council's job, it's the government's job, but what can I do to make my community better?
But the money isn't going to them, is it? It's going to big companies like Serco.
Well, with big companies, I think one has to look quite carefully. I'm a fan of in-house, of keeping things in-house, but what one has to ask, since it is our money being used, that sometimes, and without a doubt it's the case, let's look at leisure centres, for instance, there is good value for money to be made in the fact that you can go to a company that might be running the leisure services for maybe four or five different authorities, and you can get better value for money out of it. And that is pretty much the same, I suspect, with the refuse collections, that they're not just doing a refuse collection for Bristol. And so we are looking at good value for council taxpayers' money as well. So it's not all as bad as it seems. Yes, of course they're in it to make a profit. I mean, nobody's there to lose money. But it's also, it could at the same time be saving money for council taxpayers, because you're getting, once again, it's, you get better value if they're giving the service to six authorities rather than to one authority.
What about the case though in Norwich that was a part of that documentary there, where the company that was supposed to be providing the services just simply went bust?
Well, presumably it was doing it just too cheaply, and it hadn't got it organised properly at all. I mean, you do have to kind of work out your profit margins, and I think that's probably one of the dangers where you've got several private companies bidding for a service, that they go and underbid and end up by not being afforded to deliver it.
Now, our next story is also a song. 25 years ago, this song made it to number 12 in the charts, and it's all about racism and corruption in the Metropolitan Police.
Every time I drive, me car police stop me super star. Through me drive a Fiat and a Mercedes with me Lancia, yeah. Some more time I'm gonna ease and down for check some company. Them a tell them produce insurance license and emoti. But me say, police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. To everybody in the downtown I dedicate this style. Whether you are lawbreaker or you are informer, you could be a PCC idea inspector. Me no charge for murder, failing to produce is where me charge for. So police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Cause me a smile the culture and used to drive up a Lancia. And me a drive care from me a teenager. Police officer me is a expert driver. So if you see me say no shout or no holler, no stand up in the road with a torch and try pull me over. Cause if it's a dark night myself you will get run over. No come behind me the road and start flash your flasher. I come rev it beside me pan your scooter. Come is a man who woulda just drive faster. And when me feel like it, me woulda pull up on a corner. Before you ask any question, me already have a answer. And any answer you get me one, you know it would be farmer. So police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. Police officer no give me producer. Police officer no bother give me producer. I'm where your people spell me pass through Victoria. And through me a entertainer, say no tax pan me window. As me go through the lights, the whole road take over. And as me drive near, I could see clear, I was a black Mariah. With six and seven plainclothes police officer. Them didn't look the type of police me could give a fiver. First thing that come into my head, good thing me hide me ganja. Next thing that happen, them waving, other words pull me over. I'm a good that do is sigh and shrug me shoulder. And as them approach me, start wind down me window. Me I go tell you how me answer. Every question them fire. What's the name, son? My name's Smiley Culture. Yeah, where do you think you're coming from, lad? From seeing my mother. What's the registration number of the card? And I can't remember. What you got in the building, son? I can't say Ricardo. Would you like to have a look? Shy, bloody man, if we ask you answer. Now take the keys out of the car and step out of the motor. Me and my colleagues have got a few questions to ask ya. You'll be on your way as soon as we get an answer. As me come out to the camera, I think I'm me, I wonder what police officer could want with Smiley Culture. With them touch, them I search the interior. But whatever them looking for, me hiding place superior. But the way them a search me, hard to ask them what them a look for. But me try handle them cause they
them just handle me closer. Then one draw and go put him on pan me shoulder and say, we ain't got no time to waste, we don't think you have need. Just give us what we want, the real sense in mania. Me never had no chance, me draw out me ganja. As me do that, them start rub them on together. One time, she will put me in the van or in the back of the river. Me say, you can't do that, come in name Smiley Culture. You what did you do that record company translator? In the reggae charts, number one was its number. More kids love it, and so does my mother. Tell you what I'll do, a favor for a favor. Just sign your autograph on this piece of paper. Me cut in shots and me just draw out me Parker. The producer me just sign Smiley Culture. They never lie, they never bother. Arrest me or take me ganja.
Number 12 in 1985, Smiley Culture there, who died this week by being raided by the Scotland Yard Drug Squad, who incidentally were described by former Drug Squad officer Duncan McLaughlin, who also wrote a book in 2002 called The Filth, the explosive story of Scotland Yard's top undercover cop. And he described them as the best organised criminal gang in Britain. Well, around one person a week, particularly ethnic minorities, die in police custody. And so families have set up a campaign which marches on Downing Street every October. While the UK press hardly report the march, Freeview and satellite channel Russia Today do. Here's Laura Emmett, who was there last September when hundreds of victims' families marched once more on Downing Street.
If you want to be heard, they say, sometimes it's better to whisper than to shout. These people are relying on that as they take to the streets to tell the silent story of loved ones who've died in British police custody. Ziaullah is here because of his brother. A recovering drug addict, Habib Paps, died in 2008 following a routine stop and search by the police.
He died whilst he was being restrained by them. Now, when I say restraint, it's one officer at his throat, an officer on either side of his arms pulling him back, and two officers then kneeing him and hitting him in the back. And that's really how he died.
Samantha Rigg, David's brother, also died 2 years ago. Mentally ill, Sean was restrained by four police officers and bundled into a van. And in the 5 minutes it took to get to the police station, had stopped breathing. He died a short time later.
There's no ideal outcome because my brother is dead, okay? Nothing is going to bring him back, we know that. But, you know, these things have been occurring for so many years. Vulnerable mental health people are being restrained and losing their lives.
2 years on, there's been no inquest into Sean's death, and the results of investigations are often unsatisfactory.
This protest aims to give a voice to the voiceless. The vast majority of those who die in police custody belong to a class of have-nots, the marginalised, often from tough inner-city areas. More than half of them had already been involved with the mental health services. But despite more than 400 deaths, either in or directly following police custody in the last 10 years, no police officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter.
On average, one person a week dies as a result of contact with the police, according to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. And that's not even counting deaths in prison, immigration centres and mental institutions.
Police officers don't just commit other minor crimes, but they commit the crime of murder and manslaughter. And that's the main reason people are here today, to let everybody know that this is going on and asking people to do something about it. If there are human rights abuses in Iran, we complain, or in China, we complain, but human rights abuses happen in Britain and there seems to be a silence.
That's worth shouting about, these people say. But this protest fell on deaf ears. The police at Downing Street refused to take their petition and they had to leave it tied to the railings.
A simple letter for the Prime Minister.
Laura Emmett, RT, London.
Now, and that report is quite disturbing, Dave. Dave Morris, a Conservative councillor. Can you say what do you think is going on here? We've had 400 deaths in 10 years, and not one single conviction for manslaughter or for murder.
Well, it is surprising, actually. When you get figures of 400, that's not something that I would have thought about. I have seen police arrest certain individuals who are high on drugs and alcohol, and the officers are flaying their hands around and everything else, and the police do go in large numbers to eliminate any injury to any individual's officer.
But it does seem as if there's almost a culture of impunity here, that it's one law for the police and another law for everybody else.
Well, you know, I've can't really possibly comment on the police. You know, it's not my field of expertise. I don't know what the causes are. I don't know who investigates the deaths in prison. Many cases, a lot of these people will die probably because they have an underlying health problems.
But it does seem that there's actually quite a lot of the people that have died in custody over the last 10 years have been from ethnic minorities.
Well, you know, that maybe that there's more drugs and alcohol involved in that particular group. I don't know. You know, I already can't really pass comment on why it should be mostly ethnic minorities.
Okay, Sylvia Dubal, you're a Lib Dem councillor here in the city. This is quite a disturbing case, this one specific one, but it's part of a general pattern, isn't it? We heard there that we've had 400 deaths in custody of one sort or another in the last 10 years.
Yes, I think it is difficult to comment on, but I think what one has to acknowledge is that the police are not any different from any of the rest of us. They're just ordinary people, and you get good and bad in everything. So maybe it's not entirely surprising. What is surprising is that the investigations usually done by another police authority are not coming to any sort of concrete conclusions. I think it's also a very well-known fact that the number of stop and searches on the ethnic minority groups are very much greater than on the white groups. So I think there is a problem. I think it's very sad that the police refused to take the petition in. I think that is deeply regrettable, because what's to be so bad about taking in a petition from people?
That actually was at Downing Street, so it was the Downing Street and David Cameron and Nick Clegg that refused to take the petition.
Well, I think that's very sad. I thought if we're an open society, then that a petition is an expression of people's kind of anxiety and distrust of something, and that there should have been, that should have been accepted.
One of the things that's part of this campaign of the friends and families of people who have died is that they say, almost every single one of them, they have no confidence in the Independent Police Complaints Commission.
I think that probably needs to be looked into quite carefully, because clearly there is something wrong. I think it would be foolish to deny that 400 deaths are all accidental. I'm sure some of them are. I can understand how some of them, people have died in custody when they're drunk, and they've died by swallowing their own vomit and people haven't noticed it, and when they're flailing around and they've had underlying problems, but that can't be 400, and I think clearly there ought to be some definite sort of investigation of this.
What about this whole business of so many people who the police are having to deal with have got mental health problems? Do you think maybe we've made mistakes in the past, that we've closed down a lot of our mental institutions, and the police are having to spend a lot of their time dealing with people who maybe should be being looked after?
I think this has been the case for many years. I worked in the probation service like 30 years ago, and we were taking people in with mental health problems and putting them in prison, which is absolutely wrong, because they don't get any treatment at all. The difficulty with mental health now is that you can't force a person to take their medication, and so this is quite difficult. And people with schizophrenia, for instance, who won't acknowledge there's anything the matter with them, do become very disruptive, but nobody is able to force them. We've closed all the mental hospitals, as you say, and there aren't certainly not... The mental health care on the National Health Service does require a lot of tweaking.
Now, it's 20 to 6, and as the cuts kick in, pressure to stay in a job you don't like increases. Marina Morris.
Hello. What is the job market situation and why so many people dissatisfied with their jobs? According to the figures from the Office of National Statistics, unemployment in the UK increased by 27,000 in the 3 months to the end of January to 2.53 million, the highest count since 1994. The overall jobless rate was 8%, the highest since 1996. The situation amongst the young is breaking records. The unemployment rate for 16 to 24 years old is at record high of 20.6%, more than one in five. In its quarterly survey of the outlooks of employees for the winter of 2010-11, the Chartered Institute of Personnel Management reported falling levels of job satisfaction, increasing pressure of work in both the public and voluntary sectors, and a falling percentage of employees who believe that their work-life balance is about right. Overall, 20% of workers believe that they are at serious risk of losing their job. Nearly a third of people working in public sector believe this. Employees are also increasingly pessimistic as to their chance of finding new work if made redundant. About a third report that the employee has frozen recruitment. Worryingly, around half of all employees served said they had experienced an increase in stress at work. Stress is among the most significant causes of sick leave, which struggling companies can currently ill afford to endure. The general picture is stagnating job market, this increasing dissatisfaction. The most common reasons are the job is boring, having a bad boss, no personal time, a difficult working environment, and poor pay. Career opportunities and employment gives vital financial security and independence. We judge our prosperity and status by income. High income means a richer life and better standards of living. Quantity of money and quality of life are intimately related. But question is, what does it mean if you are dissatisfied with your job? Is life only about valuing money and ignoring your true feelings? And what are the consequences of ignoring it? Let's critically examine the links between money and dissatisfaction. Constant disappointment, stress, long-term depression will affect your health. Positive emotions and feelings are foundation of your well-being and are where come from quality of our life. And life is a competition of abilities. You can't compete as well in the job market. Your performance would be poorer than colleagues who have passion towards their job. You might fall to reach your potential. The real picture is by making money in the wrong job for you, you are starting to destroy yourself. Can you call this progress, especially if we are talking about a lifelong journey? No amount of money can buy back the wasted years. It is an intellectual puzzle for us. Do our basic needs include only material sustenance, or do we need another compass to include both these financial factors and the enjoyment of life? Now 2.53 million face a situation of trying to find a job. Is any job a good job in this situation? Will many of these people value their future health and protect themselves from stress and depression? Will they invest in personal development or just take Hobson's choice? And what do the people of Bristol think about job satisfaction? UK's unemployment is at its highest level in 17 years, at 2.53 million people. According to the Chartered Institute of Personnel Management, job satisfaction is also falling. Why do so many people hate their job?
I love my job. I very much love my job. I don't know, lots of people who don't like their jobs, I think it's probably overall to do with the recession, pay cuts, lots of things. People maybe just having to take a job for the sake of getting something to pay money, and it's maybe not something they're interested in, but more doing it for the sake of earning some money.
I do like my job, yes. Mostly, I think they're bored in their job. I think that's really why they don't enjoy it. And I suspect they're bored because they didn't put enough investment in advance to actually obtaining the job in terms of education and planning for what they wanted to do.
I very much enjoy my work. If there is dissatisfaction at work, then it causes stress, which can affect people's health, and it can create problems. How they feel towards the people they're working with, and obviously it depends what job they're doing, but if it's with the public, then there's going to be a problem.
I think that people don't like their jobs because they have to work, and if people just did whatever they wanted to do, they'd probably be a lot happier. People work to feed themselves at the end of it. We're just animals trying to survive in the environment that we have, and the environment that we have is 21st century modern human society.
Most people hate their job because they just want more leisure time, don't they? Most people just go to work to be able to live rather than to enjoy it. Balance, isn't it? It's getting the balance right.
What are the attributes of a perfect job?
You're going to be working for the substantial portion of your life, and therefore you've got to do something that you really like. In terms of what makes a good job, I don't know, being valued by your employer, being well remunerated, good benefits, a nice working environment, pleasant colleagues, all of that sort of thing, I think all contribute to making a good job.
I think it's essential that your job mirrors your own personal abilities and interests, frankly. I think it's very difficult to continue in a job where you don't actually take any satisfaction from it and you're not enjoying it.
If you choose a career that you enjoy, then you're going to get a lot of satisfaction from it.
Well, I suppose the attributes of a perfect job are a job that you wake up and you look forward to going to do, whatever it may be. That everyone's got a talent, whether you know how to access it or not, but everyone is good at something.
I suppose a perfect job is obviously something you enjoy doing. It could be associated with a hobby or something like that. I mean, I'd like to be flying all day long, flying planes, because, you know, that's something that I would like doing, but it's something you can't do, isn't it, all the time?
Is any job a good job when unemployment is so high and increasing?
I don't think it would be good for somebody to sort of rush into taking a job just for the sake of getting money. There are always other options, whether it's retraining, whether it's looking at getting support from other people, whether it's taking a career break or whatever it might be, or, you know, transferring your skill set. So I don't think it's a good idea just to take any job for the sake of getting a job. I think
you do need a job that not only will pay you enough to ensure that you have a satisfactory standard of living, but also I think you do have to have enjoyment from the day-to-day tasks that you're involved in. So no, not any job is a good job.
No, not any job. It goes against your values, or if you're dissatisfied and you could do so much better, then you would be better spending more time searching for a better job than actually doing something that made you miserable. But on the other hand, it is good to be working, and it gives you a sense of purpose in life. It's a complex.
That's Marina Morris out on the streets of Bristol this week, asking you whether you think it's worth staying in a job you hate. Now, Sylvia Dubell, Lib Dem councillor, can you just tell us what you think? Is any job a good job?
Well, clearly, we can't all be doing a job we choose. Someone's got to do the jobs that are least attractive, otherwise we'd be in a dreadful state. And I do believe that it is necessary to work. And if your job isn't giving you satisfaction, then you'll have to look for it outside. We all have a duty to take control of our own lives. And so maybe your job isn't giving you huge satisfaction, but then you look for that in your pastimes and your hobbies and what else you're offering. But I do think it's necessary to work in this day and age, not just for money, but for self-respect.
As Marina's saying there, there simply aren't enough jobs to go round. We've had an even more of an increase in unemployment over the last few months.
We have, but I think you'll find there are jobs that people, well, in fact, I know there are jobs that people are just not prepared to do, which is why we have quite a lot of people coming from the European Union to do the jobs that our people simply do not want to do.
Is that because those jobs don't pay enough?
I think it's because they're probably quite labour intensive, like cutting cabbages and harvesting, and it's quite hard work. And it's the younger people particularly who've got no work ethic at all. This is the problem. They've come from school with no serious work ethic, and they're not able to stick doing it for sort of 7 hours a day. They just can't do it.
Isn't there something wrong here? Because you know, if it's something that's an unpopular thing that people don't want to do, you'd expect that people would be paid more for that.
Well, I suspect that because this is going through, like for instance, cutting cabbages, you've got the farmer, you've got the middleman, you've got the supermarket. I can see that the initial pay is pretty low, and it's probably the minimum wage, and maybe there is some kind of incentive that one could offer by taking people who are on the job list and getting job seekers allowance to give them a bit of extra money. But I think that the difficulty is that I'm sure there are jobs around. And certainly there are jobs around in different parts of the country, and maybe the people do have to sort of move around a little bit more.
Now, Dave Morris, Conservative councillor, should you choose a career or should you just take any job?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. When you're at school and you've got a chance of looking at your career and career advice, then yes, you can have a choice at that stage. But when you get to a certain age, and if you are made redundant and you have a family with children and a mortgage, you've got to keep those standards up. So any job that comes along may well be the fact you have to take it. But you know, when you talk about unemployment, I see on the Evening Post yesterday there's a company wanting to employ up to 200 people in Bristol, and they're recruiting for the first 60, and having difficulty in filling the numbers.
But what about what Sylvia was saying there? Is that people are coming from Eastern Europe and other parts of the world to take these jobs?
Well, not so much in Bristol. Certainly, the jobs that Sylvia was describing, yes, they're certainly going on to East Anglia and the Fens, which is the big, boring, hard, back-breaking work, which the Eastern Europeans are quite happy to come over and to do, but a lot of our people don't.
So do you think there are enough jobs to go around then?
I think there are enough jobs.
Well, what's happened in the Evening Post over the last 3 or 4 years? I've noticed that it's gone from about something like 12 pages or even more a week of jobs down to about 2.
Mm. Well, I can't possibly on the Evening Post. I don't look for jobs in the Evening Post.
Well, I'm saying is the number of jobs in there every week have massively shrunk.
Well, there's Bristol's level of unemployment is fairly low by the accounts, according to the rest of the country. I can't remember the exact figure now. But there are jobs in the country generally. They talk about 500,000 jobs are vacant. And I noticed 2 days ago that, I won't mention their name, but a supermarket is going to Croatia to recruit for their next stores.
Well, why is that?
You tell me. I don't know why. And we've got this unemployment here.
Well, I think it's maybe, isn't it? Possibly because they're not paying very much.
Well, do they pay the minimum wage? But there's obviously, I would have thought there'd be lots of opportunities for enhancement through these supermarkets. They do actually end up paying quite well.
So you're convinced there are enough jobs around there, and that it's actually the job seekers' fault that they're not taking these jobs, as Marina was saying, that there are more and more unemployed people all the time right now, and it looks as if the unemployed figures are skyrocketing. Mm. I was talking to someone the other day who was going to sign on at the job centre, and there was just a massive queue of people who had obviously lost their jobs recently and waiting to sign on.
No, I can't put any comment about that, obviously, because I don't... I haven't been to any job centres recently, but there are seems to me to be a lot of jobs about. I'm not saying that there are more jobs than people looking for the jobs.
But it's a recession, Dave. It's a recession.
We have a recession, exactly. We have a recession at the moment, and of course, a lot of the jobs that are going are local authority jobs or civil service jobs, because they've been over the last 10 years. You find that the biggest employer in the country have been the government and the local authorities, as against the private industry. And the private industry can't keep all the government jobs flowing. So those are the ones that are being lost at the moment. Hopefully now that intake is going to be taken up by the private industry.
Okay, on to our next story. Squatting is to become a crime. The police will be able to turf out intruders. Triumphant headlines in the Daily Mail today. The era of squatters' rights is at an end, the Daily Mail can reveal. Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark, who's also part of the elitist Bilderberg Group, an international financial terrorist, is to scrap existing soft-touch laws and make occupying a private property illegally a criminal offence. It will mean the police can enter a property by force and evict the occupants within days. Sylvia, is this a good move, do you think?
Once again, these headlines are complex. It's not a simple issue, really. They're certainly, generally speaking, I would say it is a good issue, but there are some homes, private owned homes, where people have bought them entirely to leave them empty, with a view to making money on them. And that isn't right either when we have a housing shortage. So the headline sounds great, but it isn't that simple, really. There's a lot of homes where nobody has lived in them for years. They've were bought for a snip, and the person just sitting on them waiting one day to make a huge profit.
Well, it's not just homes we're talking about here, because we've just heard today that the Hub, which was used to be used by Bristol City Council as a homeless advice centre and which was housing about 20 people, the bailiffs have turned out today and evicted them out of some empty offices.
Well, I think this is the complexity of the case, really. There are some cases where clearly you mustn't let people go and squat on your buildings, and that is wrong. If you're refurbishing a building, if it's office things, no, they shouldn't be allowed to squat it. So I think it needs to be looked into a lot more carefully. Yes, we shouldn't have squatters, but if we're not going to have squatters, we must do something to make landlords sitting on empty properties let them, because this is what is wrong. And also we must have more places for homeless people to go to.
Dave Morris, you're a Conservative councillor. What's your thoughts? Are you glad to see this in the Daily Mail today? Squatting is to become a crime?
Yes, I do. I think it's the best thing that's happened for a long time. I think this is where Scotland took the lead. There's a criminal offence in Scotland, up to 21 days imprisonment if you found squatting.
But what about what Sylvia was saying there about people that just simply, they've taken their money out of the stock market and they've decided they're going to invest in property, even though they've got no intention of living there?
I didn't say about investing in the stock market, but yeah, you know, obviously any empty houses, any property that are left empty are totally wrong. What I'm talking about is those that are occupied, that are people's families' homes. They are either vacant because they've been refurbished and the family's moved out, as a recent case in London. The family moved out, refurbished their house, and just before they get back in again, squatters move in.
Well, one case in point was Colonel Gaddafi's son's house in London was squatted last week. Now, he's obviously not in London, is he? He's over in Libya fighting the rebels. So what about people that have all these houses in different parts of the world and they hardly ever use them?
Well, no, that is something I've got no aspirations to have all these houses. There's a different world to me, you know. I'm not a multimillionaire. I'm just a local councillor in Bristol. But I worry about the ordinary family man who goes away, or an elderly person who has a house over in, say, Spain.
Well, I think you'll find that almost all the squats, certainly in this city, are in places which are empty. And, of course, in a recession, there are more and more places being empty. In a way, it's almost like a growth industry.
But that's the point. But it's not all empty. They may be vacant at that moment in time, but they're still owned by somebody, and it's somebody's home. And in fact, I think the latest group, and there is they have a website, and they have it's very well organised. And a lot of the last group from Eastern Europe were saying they wouldn't be allowed to do this in their own country because it's a criminal offence. It seems to be like in Britain that they can get away with it.
I'll give you the final word on this, Sylvia. How do you distinguish between buildings that have just been left empty for years and when someone has just gone away on holiday for a few weeks?
I think there's no doubt about it that the local authority know which buildings have been empty for years. I mean, there's by the council tax and various other databases, they are well aware of what it is, and this is where the legislation needs to come in to make sure that people that have just bought houses, and that some of them have sat on these houses for 30 years and they've never had anybody living in them, and yes, they do get squatted and they get evicted. This is what is wrong. We've got to do something to stop people doing this just for sheer financial gain.
Okay, and our final story, 39,000 more fall into mortgage arrears. This is in the Daily Mirror. The number of people struggling to pay their mortgage rose by nearly 40,000 in the last quarter of 2010. After decreasing for each quarter since the start of 2009, the number of cases of arrears jumped 6% on the previous 3 months. It took the total number of arrears to roughly 350,000, according to new figures published by the Financial Services Authority. Now, this is a bit concerning, Dave, isn't it? We've got 350,000 people in Britain now who can't pay their mortgage.
This is very disturbing. You know, when I really do feel sorry for them, it's got to be horrendous because it ruins their families, their...
So what's David Cameron going to do about it then?
Well, I don't know. I would say I'm not the financial expert. I'm not the one who's got the figures. I'm not the one who issues. I'd like to see the banks lend more and be more friendly. You know, we got the banks out of the hole in the first place, and I'd like to see the banks now lending far more money and supporting people who are struggling.
Sylvia, in a word, what's your thought on this story, just quickly?
Well, I think what's got to happen is that people have got to perhaps pay interest-only mortgages for the time being.
Well, thanks very much for this week's guests, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dubell, and Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Dave Morris. After the news, nuclear reactors plus the Muslim ideas for what's going to be happening in the Middle East.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...